Welcome to Pop and Lock. I'm Natalie Dalzicki.
And I'm Landry Ayers.
Jordan Peele stepped out of his Key and Peele comfort zone to bring us not one, but two genre-defying horror films. Get Out cleverly uses common horror tropes to reveal truths about how damaging racism still is in our modern world. Us, as the title suggests, tells a story about how neglecting to come to grips with our past makes us our own worst enemies. Joining us today for a deep thriller discussion is film critic and culture reporter at Vox.com, Alyssa Wilkinson.
Hey, it's good to be here.
And senior contributor at Film School Rejects, Kiera Wardlow.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, Jordan Peele's movies, Get Out and Us, that we'll be talking about today, his debuts in the horror genre as a filmmaker, both reinvigorated and shone a light on a genre that has been around for a long time but has not nearly been appreciated by a mass audience as it now has hopefully begun to be, and that is the genre of black horror. It even inspired a class, I believe, at UCLA that integrates Get Out into the curriculum, but is about the many films in cinema history in the genre of black horror. Why is it horror is considered a primarily white genre?
You know, there have been black faces in horror for basically as long as horror has been a genre, but they've been white stories. So it's, you know, horror is, there's an assumption for what the audience is afraid of in a horror film, of what's going to terrify people. So you kind of have to have a standard in mind of who your audience is. And historically, in American horror film, it's been a white audience. It's been what will scare this white middle-class audience has been kind of the audience and the way that horror films have been created.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's really reflective of the industry at large, which, you know, has basically assumed that for like a century that the kind of default viewer of a movie is a white person, and thus tailored the, you know, what's scary to white people, and disregarded, you know, kind of what maybe was going on in society, because we have to remember that horror is a genre about that really captures our anxieties as people, both kind of individuals living in bodies and also in a social manner. And then on top of it, there's always been this presumption that that like people, white people don't see movies that star black people. That's been a really long running presumption, even in the face of obvious, you know, kind of evidence in the other direction. It's been a really long running presumption in Hollywood. So those things really have contributed to what is an overwhelmingly white centric genre. And I think part of what was so brilliant about Get Out is that, you know, Jordan Peele just easily is one of the better horror filmmakers that I've ever seen working. But he also figured out how to evoke a feeling that maybe in the past a Hollywood executive would have said, oh, well, you know, white people aren't going to go see that movie.
I also think that Peele has an exceptional ability to take snippets from all types of horror genres. And by that, I mean, in both Get Out and in Us, which I'm sure we're going to dive into both as we go on here, but he'll take snippets from each type of horror, whether it's intruder comes into the house or whether it's doppelgangers and this idea of being like fearful of yourself or what have you. But I think he does a really good job, not only of using symbols throughout these two horror films, but also taking interesting tidbits from other very famous movies within the genre.
I mean, I would agree with that. I think the thing is that he hits that sweet spot, right, between commercially viable and really commercially successful and like kind of critically acclaimed, and that there's kind of, there's layers and there's food for thought in his films. And I think the key to that is his way of incorporating the familiar, because I think fundamentally, we do kind of like familiar stories, but we want them to be new enough or different enough that we don't feel like we're watching the same thing over again, you know, like it's repetitive. And I think that a key thing that's missed out in that kind of, in many ways, still prevailing stereotype that, oh, you know, white audiences aren't going to want to watch a film with black leads, with, you know, non-white kind of principal roles, is that showing diverse perspectives and having stories told by diverse creators is actually a great way to sort of tell a very similar story, but with that fresh perspective that makes it feel a little new and a little different and something, you know, that kind of hits that sweet spot between being kind of too out there and too familiar.
Yeah, I agree. And I also wanted to note that one of the genres he does really well is body horror. And that's what Get Out really is a look at the bigger kind of social, I don't want to use the word phenomenon, the social ill of racism, but through the lens of body horror, which really gets at, you know, that this is about the body you live in and the way you are presented to the world and also who's looking at you and what they're thinking and what they want from you. I felt like I was shivering by the time I got out of the first screening of Get Out because I felt it so much in my body. And that was a really phenomenal experience.
I was just going to say that, you know, I agree that it's a body horror fundamentally in talking about, you know, kind of body invasion and someone taking over your body. But one thing that really stuck out to me more rewatching the film, you know, the first time you're watching it, you're still trying to figure out exactly what's going on and what have you. But then rewatching it is the way that he uses dialogue. Because I'm a big dialogue person and like how words are being used. And so much of the sense of discomfort or that something's weird is going on when he's talking to the other Black people who've already, you know, been sort of brainwashed and occupied and become, you know, just sort of bystanders within their own bodies, is he goes to them as, you know, another Black person. He tries to interact with them as another Black person, and they react like white people reacting to a Black person in the actual dialogue. Like, I think there's that one exchange where he says, "Oh, I didn't mean to snitch on you." And then, you know, she goes, "Oh, you mean tattletale?" Like, I just think that there's so much there that I really appreciated so much more, you know, the second time around and kind of knowing where it was going.
Yeah. And you can see, once you know the twist, the fact that there are these white personalities that have been transplanted into these Black people's bodies, and those personalities, or at least vestiges of them, are still locked inside in the sunken place, watching as sort of observers of this entire scenario going around. Rewatching it takes on a whole new meaning of, even when there's not dialogue, like, for instance, when the tears begin to come out of her eyes, there's this moment of fighting going on where it's like that last bit of personality that is still on the inside is almost pushing its way out. And then the flash, which to me, you know, becomes very reminiscent of, you know, the camera motifs and lenses, which sort of bring to mind the sort of meta text of the movie being about, you know, horror films and what they mean and what they show and that social context that it exists in. It sort of tries to bring them out of that and really does sort of, it is emblematic of what the film is trying to do, not only in the plot of it, but in the social context that it exists in. And I appreciated it and really enjoyed a lot of the plot and what it was saying on that surface level the first time I saw it. But I was pleasantly surprised how much I enjoyed it on a second watch, because I don't watch a lot of horror movies generally on my own.
Scaredy
anyway. a little bit. You're not wrong. But I also, there's a part of me that always is kind of like, well, am I going to enjoy it as much the next time? You know, part of the initial thrill of it comes from being on the edge of your seat, not knowing what's coming next, the subversion of expectations, or playing with those. But it really does read even more deeply on a second and third watch through, which I really, really appreciated.
I also think that the movie is so visceral in a sense, and what makes it such a groundbreaking horror film is that very fact, I think, that Landry just hinted at, is that this is one of the few horror films I can think of that I actually enjoy rewatching. A lot of horror films, like I just saw Midsommar, I've seen Hereditary, a lot of those like were shocking and very disturbing with the first watch. And I came away with the first watch being like, well, I never really need to see that again, because now I know everything that happened, and it's the context isn't as deep. And because this movie is so visceral, when you're watching, you get to it feels like you're going through the experience. And that's just a credit to not only Peele's work, but everyone who worked on the film. And I also think another thing that Landry brought up that I was hoping we could delve into more is this a larger idea of sight. Landry brought up like the camera flashing and how Chris is obviously a photographer. And in the end, what happens is like the person, the white personality that like auctions, that wins the auction for Chris, wants his eyes because he's a blind artist. And it's this whole idea that I believe that, I'm not sure if this is the exact quote, but the blind artist was like, I don't really need your body. What I want is I want to see through your eyes. I want to see the world the way you see it, which was such a great, well, not, it was also like the climax of the movie, but it was such a great line. And I'm definitely jumbled it. But what did you guys think of the symbols of sight, and what do you think the larger meaning throughout the film, what do you think their larger meaning was?
Well, I also think it's interesting just in particular is that he's not necessarily even an artist himself. He is an art dealer. And right. He even says at one point, like, I pitched to National Geographic 14 times before I realized I didn't have like the gift, he calls it, but that he is a person that wants to take something from Chris to sort of reappropriate his gaze and then profit off of it, as opposed to actually create something on his own, which is, I think, another commentary that could definitely be made.
The thing that's interesting to me about that whole kind of element of the story is, to me, it feels very reminiscent of a very kind of classic, but not very well-remembered novel called Trilby, which is where the term Svengali comes from, which is what kind of its biggest lasting legacy in the character Svengali. It's a bit of an anti-Semitic stereotype, but he's this maestro, but he can't sing. And there's this woman who's tone deaf, but has this great voice. So he hypnotizes her to use her like a puppet or like an instrument. And that's kind of the whole story. And it was huge. It was like the biggest bestseller of its era. It kind of died out, but it's, again, to me, I think with Jordan Peele, like there's these threads, and whether they're conscious or just, you know, it's very possible for different writers and creatives to have this like the same or very similar ideas, but either whether it's a conscious kind of reference or it's just, you know, coming up with the same sort of thing that's echoing something else that's been done already, it's like it's tapping into those kind of historically very popular themes but putting a very different twist on them. And I mean, I think as his perspective as a, you know, a Black man who's been working in the entertainment industry for a long time already at this point, I think there's commentary specific to his experience in that too. In, you know, it's this mostly predominantly overwhelmingly white system that now sees particular value in your perspective as a Black person, but they still want to use it for their own aims and use it as a tool, you know? So I think there's a lot there to that aspect of the story.
Yeah, I mean, this is very surface level, but it's just funny to me. I recently watched Gremlins for the first time, which is another horror film. And you know, that thing with the flashing camera comes up again in that film. And I was like, where have I seen this before? And then I realized it was Get Out. I was like, well, that is not the same thing. Although maybe it is. I don't know. There's some kind of analysis to be done there. But I, you know, I think to your point, Kara, there's this theme of eyes and sight and looking, and you know, the photography and the framing of an image is so much about who's doing the looking and who's being looked at. And this film is so much about that, right? And it's making a larger point about the industry and who's been allowed to do that, while also making like, you know, and we have to say this is a profoundly entertaining film. It's very funny. It's the last film I can remember in kind of recent memory that managed to have like kind of instant catchphrases in it. You know, the line about like voting for Obama the third time, not to mention the idea of being in the sunken place, like that was, as soon as I saw it, I was like, oh, there we go. That's the meme. But they actually mean something. Right. But yeah, that kind of idea of like who's getting to do the looking and why. And also, like you're saying, where when the perspective changes, and suddenly maybe something that would have normally been pushed off to the side of the screen is now in the middle of the screen. But then the question is, why is it in the middle of the screen? And that's so much of what this movie gets at. And I think, you know, in particular, Black filmmakers have been good at bringing that into the way that we think about film through actually making films about it. You know, and it's another way of kind of challenging what we white people would expect when we go to the theater, and challenging it and saying like, maybe you weren't aware you were being centered, and we're going to make you aware of that. And, you know, it's good. It makes us uncomfortable. And then he manages to make us really uncomfortable, also scare us, and also make us laugh a lot.
As soon as you mentioned it, it sort of clicked with me. I don't think that the Gremlins illusion actually, it may not be on accident. I think it could definitely be on purpose, because there is a great Key and Peele sketch. If you go back and watch an episode where Jordan Peele plays a consultant that is brought on to punch up the script for Gremlins 2, and they basically just... they basically just pull out all of these things that are actually in Gremlins 2 and say like, ooh, what if we did this? And it's hilarious and just sort of highlights the absurdity of that movie. So I would not be surprised if Jordan Peele is a big Gremlins fan and had to slide that in. But you brought that, you bring up the idea of the intense level of comedy that is in the movie. And that's one thing I really, really appreciate. And obviously, Jordan Peele has a lot of experience with both of these genres that, I mean, when you first think about them, you're like, how could they be? You know, they're two completely opposite sort of feelings. But they do employ a lot of similar techniques and are about playing with expectations and surprising you and subverting you. What is... Do you find the purpose of the role of comedy in this movie? And in particular, one that I'm curious about is what do you think of the character Rod, and what role does he play? Because he is just the traditional comic relief at first, but he very much serves an important story role, I think, as well.
He's also everyone's TSA agent. Come on.
He handles it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about Rod, right, is in a way... he's kind of a bit of a conspiracy theorist, because he has some ideas that are crazy, but then in the end, they also end up being true. So I think it's this interesting sort of combination of being sort of the comic relief, but also like the straight man, and like the sense of like he's the voice of reason, right, ultimately, and the one who kind of saves the day. And, you know, I think especially for sort of Black audiences, there can be parts where when Chris is like still sticking around at the house, when all the stuff's gone down, that he's not just been like, oh no, I'm getting out of here, you know, like that you can just get a bit fed up with him on that front of like, seriously, my dude, you're still there. Yeah. So then there's Rod, who you can kind of identify with, because he's being the voice of reason, being like, something weird is going on, you need to leave. So, I mean, I think that that's a very interesting character. Like, I think it's very important that his character is there.
Yeah, I remember reading too that the initial ending of this was not going to end the way it did. Because when you watch the movie, right, we sort of have this, you know, they're crawling away from the house, everything's gone down, and he's finally made it out. We're so happy for him. And then the sirens, you know, or the car pulls up, and we're like, oh no. You know, like, we know what happens when the cops show up, especially in this context. And I think it was a conscious choice. I don't actually remember what Peele has said about this, but I know that this has come up several times in discussions of the film, that initially that was Rod was not coming to save the day. It was going to sort of be like what might be a more realistic ending, unfortunately. And they punted that. I'm guessing it didn't test very well with audiences, but it also is just kind of good to know when you're watching that soaring feeling of relief you have when he gets out of the car is not is not necessarily what the ending was intended to be.
I mean, I feel like that, though, is a pretty standard Hollywood story for what happens to an ending, though. I mean, there are other horror films, you know, that you hear similar where it's like, it was going to be this downbeat ending, but then they tested for the lines, like, no, we can't do that. Like, 28 Days Later had, like, a similar thing happen. The protagonist was supposed to die, but then they're like, no. Mm-hmm. That's that people were saying that tested too poorly. He lives now, and it's a bit of a weirdly upbeat ending. But I think, again, in the context of, like, the history of horror films, there's an interesting thing that this one does when Rod does come save the day at the end, when you see, you know, the flashing lights and you're like, oh no, the cops, this is going to go terribly. And then instead it's Rod there to save the day. It kind of, to me, feels like an inverse of what happens at the end of Night of the Living Dead, which is probably, you know, one of the first kind of iconic starring, you know, black lead roles in like an iconic American horror film. And he thinks that rescue is coming, and instead he gets, you know, shot and killed, and that's the end. And that was a huge twist ending. So I think there's something interesting there in how the ending of Get Out almost feels like the inverse of that.
So in like preparation for this podcast, I was reading up on I think Alyssa might have alluded to it, but I was reading up on I believe it was a GQ interview that Peele did about his choice of the ending, because they actually had an alternate ending, like Alyssa said, where Chris actually ends up going to jail, and there's a scene in it. I watched the alternate ending. There's a scene in it that Chris is talking to Rod, and Chris is in a orange jumpsuit, and they're in the where they're talking through a telephone but looking through each other through glass in prison, and Chris is saying, you know, I got out of there. Like, I got out of there. So, and to me, I won. There's no reason for you to like fight this case. Like, I got out of there. So I, in my eyes, I won. Peele had said in the interview that they really liked that ending and thought it was powerful, and it was a powerful scene. But by the time they had rolled around to when the movie was coming out, with the political climate that the movie was released in, especially with police brutality and a lot of pessimism, that he thought America needed a more optimistic ending. And he thought the ending they created originally was kind of like a cop-out, the words he used, but he wanted to leave a more optimistic ending because he knew everyone was going to assume the ending. And he thought that he said the difference between like a good and great movie is that you can, there'll still be twists and the ending will still be able to make you think. Whereas like, I know for me, for sure, the first thing I thought was, oh, cops pulled up. Like, I could have predicted this ending 10 minutes ago. And he did exactly opposite, which makes it a great ending. Not to mention, I love the character Rod, but you know, so I just thought it was interesting that he actually admitted to looking at the climate in which the movie was being released in terms of like a political climate, and thought that they should change direction a little bit. Which I think, I mean, again, speaks to what a great director he was, for this film and for us as well. What does the sunken place represent? Like Alyssa was saying, like it was an instant meme, and you see it kind of like taken up in popular culture rather quickly, but what does it actually represent?
I mean, I think it's one of those things, you know, where I haven't like looked into, you know, obviously go with kind of if Jordan Peele's made a statement about what it's supposed to mean, you know, that's kind of the word of God in the scenario, and that's what you should go with. For me, it's one of those things where I think it's just kind of tapping into a very sort of base fear of not being in control, of not having any, you know, say in anything, of just being at the mercy of other people, of not having agency, and not because, you know, of a lack of will or interest, but just because you don't have any power, and you don't have any control. And so I think that there's just sort of a very fundamental kind of fear that taps into, like feeling like life is just something that you can't control and feeling helpless. And I do think too, there's like a kind of in the history of horror, a connection with like kind of the Haitian concept of zombie, which was brought to American audiences in like the 30s with some very like I Walked with a Zombie and White Zombie that are these, you know, very whitewashed takes on that tradition. But again, it's the idea of someone being able to, like, your body still being active, but not your own, someone else having control over you.
Yeah, I think that's really smart. And it is interesting to think about the zombie kind of history of the zombie in this respect to this film. But yeah, because I was going to say, you know, I sort of thought of it as a living grave of a kind.
Yeah.
You know, like below level, that's what a sunken place is. And it's this idea, like what happens to Lakeith Stanfield's character, where he, you know, he clearly is alive, but he's been stripped of everything that made him him, except for his actual physical body. And that that's a living death. And I think, you know, that reference certainly brings to mind death and coffins and things like that for me. Mm-hmm. And we see that in multiple characters. It's not just the one. So, so yeah, that's sort of what I had thought about. And I think that, the living death is what a zombie is. And so there's a strong connection there.
One thing that, got brought up before was the idea that, Rod is sort of a conspiracy theorist, but one thing that also parallels an idea that gets hinted at in the other movie that we wanted to talk about, which is Us, where, spoiler alert, in case you haven't seen the movie, by the end, we find out that the Tethered, which is this like mirrored quasi-zombie doppelganger-esque group of people that represents basically the other half of humanity, that was created by the government to control them, but that went wrong. Which in and of itself sounds like a conspiracy theory, but the fact that the daughter in the family then at one point brings up like, well, you know, the government puts fluoride in our water so they can control our minds. But in the end, everyone sort of like brushes her off. But then in the end, there is a government conspiracy to control people's minds with something that they've created. So what does that sort of flip of the switch and sort of making that, like you said, the comic relief turn into the straight man in this type of scenario? What does that do for Jordan Peele's movies?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a difficult one just because, right, there's like the fun, uplifting side, but there's also, I think, a dark side to that. You know, again, looking at it from, you know, the Black perspective, is there is a distrust of a lot of institutions that comes from a very historically valid place. You know, you look at something like the Tuskegee syphilis study and like other things where there have been these institutions that have done these outrageous and like, you know, forced sterilizations of, you know, women of color and like where there is a very valid distrust of institutions, but then it can also backfire because then, you know, that also leads to things of like not seeking out other forms of aid that then also leads to further problems, but you can understand why they distrust them. I mean, like, you know, I live in Harlem and I was walking down the street the other day and there was a man handing out, you know, kind of some sort of leaflet about like why not to trust, you know, any vaccines and like other sorts of conspiracy theories. And you can understand why you have that higher level of distrust, because there is this historical precedent and there's been studies even done that like in particular communities that had these things happen to them, the distrust stays higher. So it's a very relevant commentary to have a figure like Rod, you know, people like him, and that he becomes like kind of the truth teller in these sorts of stories. Like, again, historically it makes sense in a way, but then also there's a party that's like, you know, like, It's that's a kind of a hard one. And I think, again, that's why it's so effective, because it's funny, but there's also this darker side to it that gives it that further depth, you know, and really makes it an interesting, you know, character.
Yeah, I was listening to something recently and someone was pointing out that, you know, the kind of bonkers thing about some of the conspiracy theories that run amok these days is that it is true that there are conspiracies against people. It's just that the ones right. that actually turn out to be true are never the ones that people get obsessed with in the period of time. But yeah, like people have been stalked by the FBI. People have been, you know, essentially poisoned. People have been disappeared. These things happen, right? But in, you know, if we're like on Facebook looking at conspiracies right now, a lot of those, sure, they might manifest anxieties people have, but they're disconnected from the real historical fact that, you know, and sometimes they fly in opposition to the idea of the real historical facts that have actually happened, that were actual conspiracies being conducted in plain sight against, or, you know, at least plain sight of some people historically. And I, you know, I think that's an interesting way to think about it. It sort of makes me think, like, if people are talking about the conspiracy theory, that's probably not real. But if they're not talking about it, then that's the one you right. should go looking for. Yeah, I think you're totally right. And so I think, you know, having the, and I do also think that having the guy who's saying the wacky things turn out to be the right one is really indicative of this feeling where where you're like, am I crazy or is this real, you know? And then you find out it is real, and it's this kind of relief. And I think about that a lot, because it pops up also in a lot of pop culture about cults these days, where you'll actually see stories where the cult seems, you know, nuts, and then it turns out that that cult actually was right all along. And I think it speaks to people's just, you know, at times feeling totally adrift from anything could be true. We don't even know anymore. And that is a difficult place to live in.
I think also with conspiracy theories and the idea of like mistrust of institutions, or let's call it mistrust of the state, or however you want to phrase it, is pretty evident but subtle in some of these Peele films. So for the police, for instance, I think actually, yeah, they're mentioned in both films. I'm thinking about it in Us, where when they first see their doppelgangers like in the driveway, and they're in the red jumpsuits, and they try to call the police, and the police are like, oh, it's gonna be 20 minutes. And then like, to me, like, and I forget what the response was. It was a witty line the dad in the family had said. But then even later in the film, when after the gory scene where they're the white family that they are vacationing with is murdered by their own doppelgangers, and then Peele brilliantly puts in the Alexa turns on, or whatever, the Google Home turns on, and starts playing NWA's F the Police, which I thought we can talk about this in length of Peele's excellent scores and the timing of his music, which is huge in horror films, because like a lot of the emotions evoked throughout horror films have to do with the sound and the music, and the music that calms you and then jolts you. And but he has some very subtle messages, I think, specifically about the police, and we can call that an institution maybe that you can mistrust in this scenario, that I think are subtle enough that it's not like in your face, but it's there, if that makes sense.
For me, I think it just his coming from the story from the perspective of a Black man in America, you know? So I think that's the thing, right? Is if someone is making a story intent on having this message about distrust of the police, right, it's going to feel very prominent and probably quite on the nose. Whereas I think, you know, in these films, it's not like he's trying to make a statement about that. It's just his perspective as a storyteller. That's a part of his, you know, experience. So it's going to show in what he writes. So I think that's, you know, why it's there subtly, but consistently, because it's just part of his, you know, perspective that's coming into play and the stories that he tells.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's always humming underneath the surface just because it's real. Yeah, I think those are all really good points. I want to also second that his music selections are just top notch from the start.
Yeah.
I have a very clear memory of seeing Get Out because I was like, oh, like I love Key and Peele. I'm gonna go see this press screening of this movie, but I was expecting it to be a little more like Keanu, which was the movie they had made that's kind of like a stoner flick with a cat. And it got started. And the first scene, you know, has Lakeith Stanfield getting basically shoved into a car trunk and the car drives away. I was like, what is this? And then it's when the, you know, like the needle drop and the photograph start. I could feel the room come alive where people were like, this is something different than we were expecting. And this is going to be great. So kudos to Jordan Peele's music supervisor and or Jordan himself.
I was just going to say it has that very much a sort of classic, I would say like 1980s horror movie feel where, you know, it got away from like the sort of horror movies and gore and like slashers gone to the extreme, just like disturbing horror of, you know, the Saw movies and things that got really popular in, you know, the 2000s and 2010s and bounced back to the, you know, invader in the house, monster type style horror movies of the 1980s, where the scores are really, really incredible, but it still has a Jordan Peele flavor to it with the sort of the beats behind them, as well as these sort of, you know, high-pitched violins and stuff like that that you would also hear in classic movies like Stepford Wives or more modern horror movies. So it's that perfect blend. He really is an auteur, I think. And even though he didn't do the score himself, his, you know, stamp is certainly on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, I think like a lot of kind of classic horror films, when you think of music, a lot of times it is more that original scoring, like Jaws. You know, everyone knows the theme of Jaws. But for his films, like the sound design overall is very effective. But what really sticks out is his use of like these existing songs and the needle drops and the particular timing of it, where like I think that also connects to, as we've discussed already, how good he is at sort of working in references and like playing with kind of ideas or homages to a lot of existing popular culture. I think this is a further extension of that in how like brilliant he is throughout both of his features that he's directed at using music.
Yeah, like when Good Vibrations is playing and Elizabeth Moss is crawling across the floor.
Yes.
That sort of like conflict that goes on is so visceral that it's that also really stuck out at me.
Mm-hmm. Or the I Got Five on it, you know, with the family. It's just it's like, mm-hmm. you know what's happening. It's just
right. Well, I also think in terms of not only for music, but again, bringing back these all these references and symbols that Peele just kind of drops into both the movies. In Us in particular, we get a ton of Hands Across America references. Not only do we get the very beginning scene where you get like the 1980s style TV and you get the ad for Hands Across America, the little girl, she's wearing a Hands Across America t-shirt. And then the whole idea of all the doppelgangers lining up holding hands at the end of the film. I was wondering how that added to the film. Like, why is that reference there?
I mean, I think for me, you know, if you look at, again, we've talked about the connection between comedy and horror and, you know, Peele's perspective as someone who really, you know, rose to success through his incredible sense of humor and, you know, excellence as a comedic actor, is there's a certain humor in this aspect of his horror, because it's really kind of lampooning or like lambasting sort of performative allyship and yes. other such things mm-hmm. in a way, like what you see in the character of Rose, especially in Get Out. And then here with, it's like, what was having everyone hold hands across America supposed to do for anybody? You know, like
it was fighting it's hunger, a media apparently.
Yeah, right. It's like it's a media spectacle, but like, okay, people are hungry, so feed them. It's like, no, we're gonna all hold hands and form a great human chain. It's gonna show how together and whatever we are, you know. I mean, it's that sort of stuff. Yeah. Where it's like, yes, he's doing it through horror, but it is kind of a similar sensibility of like, this is ridiculous. I feel like that's kind of going on underneath it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I didn't remember. I was three when Hands Across America happened. So I went back and dug into it and discovered that they raised $34 million, but they only distributed $15 million.
Right, because the cost of the event was so high.
Right. So it's like you spent more money putting on this, you know, very visible event that, you know, frankly, like, doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me anyhow. I can imagine contexts in which holding hands across America makes sense as a stunt, but this just smacks of like every performative, you know, stunt to try and like say how we're helping people. And so that to me like made perfect sense. As soon as I saw that, I was like, okay, so in fact, less than half this money actually went to the people it was supposed to benefit. Other people got to see themselves as participating in something bigger than themselves and as being woke, you know. And then we've got this movie that's about how, you know, here's like half the people living their lives totally oblivious to the fact that there's the rest of them essentially living in this incredible, you know, horrible situation.
Right. And it speaks to the larger narrative in us, I think, too, this idea that we gloss over or we're quick to forget some of the horrors or some of the more egregious things we've done in our past. And we go and lock it away in the underground tunnels, as in us. But it like that it still lives in all of us, like it's still there, even if we continue to suppress it. And I think that's obviously part of the Hands Across America reference as well, just because it's this idea that it's self-serving. So the Hands Across America, like I think it was like 6 million people participated and they were like, oh yeah, this is for a good cause. And we donated $10 to reserve my spot in line in New Mexico. But it's like this idea that it's like, it's very self-serving and you feel like they felt like they made a difference. And like $15 million donated to starvation is really just a drop in the bucket and doesn't, I mean, yes, it's a good thing and it's a good cause. But it's one of those things that you think like, okay, like now that I did this, I held Hands Across America and I donated all this money. Now that I did this, that like I can move on. Or I've done my justice in this issue area. So now I need to help this issue area, where it's like not all that helpful as we've hinted at. And I also think it's a larger narrative about us in general. It's a larger narrative about like the struggle to remember and take care of like forgotten people. So the people that fall between the cracks. And I think part of me, I enjoyed Get Out as a film, as like an entertainment and a film better. But I think Us is a little bit more lofty.
I don't know if it's lofty for me or if it was more like it just was like a much more broadly metaphoric thing.
Right.
Like there was not as clearly a one-to-one comparison, like, oh, it's very clear that this is made to represent this, and that there's all like there are references to horror movie tropes and things like that, but the message to me seems to be a lot more universal about history and sort of learning from hubris and things like that. I didn't have the clear sense of, oh my gosh, I can see all of these tiny little things in real life as clearly as I did in Get Out. But it also feels much more like a sort of classic style horror movie in that aspect. So I watched Us for the first time today for this podcast and was pleasantly surprised and really enjoyed it because I normally don't like horror, like I said earlier. I wonder what I would think about it watching a second time, because I enjoyed Get Out even more than I thought I would on the second watch through it. And I wonder if Us would have the same effect.
I mean, I think Us is a very effective horror film. I do think it suffers from a little bit of like second film syndrome, where
absolutely
it's so hard oftentimes to get your first feature made. But on the other side of that is you go through so many drafts and revisions in order to get the funding. You know, a lot of times, even if like Jordan Peele, you're already successful in another area, you know, it's hard to do. Whereas I think in this one, you know, Get Out was so tremendously successful. That's basically like a bit of a golden ticket into the like, yes, we do what, you know, what you want to do next. We want to make, you know, another movie with you. So it doesn't feel very much very like that. Development process was much faster in this one. So I think sometimes part of the lack of like the little details kind of having those through lines in the same way just kind of comes from, I think that this was probably put together much faster and didn't have to jump through as many hoops. So like on that front, I still think it's a very effective film. I still think he's a very, you know, a great filmmaker, and I'm really excited to see, you know, what he keeps on doing going forward. But I wasn't on that front quite as impressed with this one. I think the big ideas were great. I think some of the details weren't quite as impressive.
Yeah, and the layeredness of Get Out is what contributes to its watchability. In that, you mm-hmm. know, like every time you watch it, you're seeing something new. And I'll actually say, mm-hmm. you know, because it was referenced earlier, is that I've seen like Midsommar 4 times, not because I particularly yeah. love it, although I do, but because of work. And I actually think that movie yields up some of the similar thing, although that one's very much about like insane white people.
Right.
But it's very much like what it does. And I think this is a helpful lens for looking at these two films, is that it's about something that's visceral and something that's intuitive. And it's also very visual. Like there's a lot going on the screen mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. tells you things about what's going on in the film. And I think we talked about that a bit with Get Out. And I feel like, one thing that Midsommar taught me was that I have to always be looking at everything on the screen, which of course is something that a film critic is supposed to know, but sometimes you forget because people like to talk about story. And I feel like Get Out gives us that, and Us has a bit less of that, although I would like to watch it several more times and just pay attention to like what's going on in the background. But it also has that amazing, you know, Lupita Nyong'o, great performance. Cast. Everyone's good in it, but oh my gosh. I mean, just unreal, I think. And that goes a long way. And I also think Us, for me, was like a bit of a helpful way to think about how to talk to people about what it means, as we said, to grapple with history and to not ignore it. And also to say, even if I didn't personally participate in the history that, you know, leads people to be living like these tethered, or, you know, kind of leads towards that state in a country, that I still participate in it. And I feel like that's been a really hard thing to talk to people about sometimes. And this gave me a way of thinking about that.
I think what's really interesting to me about Us is I feel like it has a very different philosophy to it than a lot of American horror films in particular. I think, you know, there's that element of like tabula rasa to it, to the storyline, to the twist, where it's the idea that Adelaide was the kind of person in the jumpsuit, and then they switched when they were kids. And so she kind of grew into being, you know, one of the sort of people in the daylight and stuff like that. So that like, it's kind of, the twist is there to emphasize that the people, you know, that these kind of creepy, scary doppelgangers are us, and they could have been us, but they were in the dark. And so that turned them into what they are, that they started off with the same potential. And that, I think, looking at the horror genre historically, is kind of its greatest sin, or kind of why it's been most problematic, is the idea of how it's used to kind of emphasize or manipulate or play into existing, you know, racism, into other biases and, you know, prejudices, where it's like, oh yes, they are scary, and just using that in order to, you know, kind of increase ticket sales and to, you know, be effective. And it's kind of a bit of a cheap way to get scares, but it's very common. And so I think Us is very interesting because it's, instead of othering, it's about these others are us. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the right. fundamental message of it, which I think is very interesting because it is so different from kind of what is standard horror.
Yeah. And we can't also miss the fact that the title Us is also the initials US. Mm-hmm. So
yes,
it's, I don't know if that counts as subtle or unsubtle, but it's certainly there.
Yeah.
And it's hard to escape, and that's good.
Well, I also think, I saw in Landry's notes, he had mentioned this, but this very, I believe it's the scene when all four of the family's doppelgangers are in the living room. It's Adelaide's doppelganger, whose also his name is Red, doesn't say we are them. She says we are Americans. Mm-hmm. That was very intentional. But I don't know if that's just because he was playing towards the audience or if that was because he or Peele thinks Americans have a higher tendency to do things like we've been hinting at, glossing over the past, not coming to grips with what has happened, or falling into this trap of this idea that everyone starts at the same place, but then there's like the falling into this trap of othering. So I think it probably plays to the audience, but I don't know, Landry, do you think there's like a larger meaning to that? Or do you think he's just trying to play to the audience to make them, to open their eyes?
I mean, to me, when I first was watching it, it stood out to me. And the more and more that I, you know, read about it and thought about the movie in the past few hours, and especially throughout this conversation, I do think it is a lot more pointed than I had originally, it sort of had hit me as. I think it's because the way it's played out and the way it's placed in the movie, you don't get the sort of full significance of what the film is trying to do until pretty much the very end. Like, mm-hmm. I was really curious. I was like, what are the tethered? Why are they motivated to do this? How, you know, what are the rules for the world and how it's working? And then after it was all done and you get the very end and you learn about this whole extra life that these people that have been forgotten about and locked away are living, it makes a lot more sense. And I think that broad metaphor really, you know, comes to fruition. And I think then it becomes much more, you know, I understood that choice in hindsight a lot more than when I had first watched it. And it didn't have like a huge impact on me. At first I was like, that seems kind of odd. Why, you know, it could have been like, we are you, or we are, you know, us, or we are, you know, something like that. In the moment, I thought they could have said that and it would have made more sense to me. But in hindsight, I do think it is much more pointed.
Yeah, I have no doubt that Jordan Peele is being very specifically American in what he's mm-hmm. what he's doing and what he's evoking. And, you know, one reason I think I kind of know that is that, you know, one of his influences for his filmmaking generally, well, you know, right after Get Out came out, he curated a series of films at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, which is near where I live, that were social horror films. And it included one of my favorite films, which is Rosemary's Baby. But of course, it included Night of the Living Dead. And Night mm-hmm. of the Living Dead is such a specifically American film about specifically mm-hmm. American anxieties about foreign invasion. And it was made during the Cold War, all of that stuff. Even though, you know, George Romero claimed that he didn't have that in mind, it's sort of obvious that it was at minimum unconsciously there when he made that film. And I think Jordan Peele's work is powerful because it's specific. You know, one of the, mm-hmm. I think one of the failures that horror and more broadly Hollywood films can fall into is trying to say something to everybody. And yeah, the more specific they are, especially when it's commentary, social commentary, the more it's actually good, you know, like the more we can actually watch it and take something away from it. And so I love that he does this. And I love that his films do function as kind of a shorthand for us to then talk about things among ourselves that might have been harder to put language to in the past, or might have been harder to to put language to, because it is hard to talk about what it is to live in my body, especially, you know, between people who have lived lives as white people and people who have lived lives as non-white people in America. It's really just difficult, even if you're trying to empathize with what's going on. It can be hard to understand. And there is something very special that film can do. And this is why I miss theaters so much. There's something that it can really do to make us feel an experience, you know, dwarfed by a screen, in a surround sound, screaming with other people, that can't maybe come across when you're just reading an article. And so I love that he's doing this. And artists have been doing this for a long, long time. It's just that, you know, something about the cinema and the fact that it's made for a popular audience, and that he's made films that are so incredibly entertaining while also really kind of socking you right in the gut, that's what makes him such an important filmmaker. And I'm guessing when we look back on this period in history, he will be one of the, if not the preeminent American filmmaker of social matters.
I would very much agree with that. I think he is so good at simultaneously, you know, kind of having that critical, those layers, and being very commercially appealing. And I think, you know, again, it's the specific, when it is done really well and in a particular way, becomes more universal because it's the specificity of those details that make it real. And so even if your experience is different, you know, it's, there is a universal, or maybe not universal, but like a shared human experience where you're, there's just, there are going to be similarities. So you are true to your experience, and then other people can connect to it because it's real. And I think that he does a very great job of that in his films that he's done thus far. And so, yeah, I think that that's a really important role as a filmmaker. And I think the thing is, again, is that he's making these stories from his perspective, but I don't think he's really trying too hard to hit the nail on the head. Cause I think sometimes as filmmakers, you see that where they're really trying to get a message across. So they're shoving it down your throat and it doesn't go so well. So, you know, I think he is a very important filmmaker, you know, and I think that's one of his strongest qualities as a filmmaker.
And now for the time in the show where we get to share all of the other wonderful pieces of media that we've been enjoying while we've been stuck inside. This is Locked In. So, Alyssa, Kira, what else have you been enjoying in your time locked in during the pandemic?
I've watched a lot of movies, obviously. I mean, there's a lot of movies coming out. So that's one reason. But also, obviously, you know, it's been really good to have things to watch and chew on and think about. I will say one movie that's just coming out now that I missed back at Sundance in January that is going to be on Netflix is The 40-Year-Old Version, V-E-R-S-I-O-N, which has a name that I think is indicative of what it's doing.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, so it's written, directed by and starring a playwright, Radha Blank, who won, I believe, a Breakthrough Award for the film at Sundance. And she plays what is obviously a version of herself, which is a 40-year-old or a woman who's 39 on the cusp of 40, who is a playwright who had like been on a 30 under 30 list in the past, but has had trouble landing a play in a theater since then. And she's kind of in an existential crisis about this. She's also teaching high school, so they're in Harlem. So there's this whole interesting group of students around her. And she, it's a really fun, like I use that word very specifically, it's a really fun takedown of the white male theater establishment, and also of the kinds of things, a little bit like what we've been talking about, that pass for diversity, quote unquote, in theater. There's a little bit at the beginning, and this is so early that this isn't a spoiler, but there's a little bit at the beginning where there's these two white ladies who are very clearly very well intentioned, but they're excitedly talking with each other about how they're really excited to have invested in a revival, a multi-ethnic revival of Fences, August Wilson's play, which is so funny to say. you know, probably like the preeminent kind of black playwright of Broadway. So anyhow, it's a very funny film. It's very delightful. It's also very insightful. Radha Blank is fantastic in it, and she wrote a fantastic movie, which is no surprise. So that one hits Netflix on October 9th. It'll be in theaters, limited theaters as well. So I've really been loving that. And then I'll just also throw in that for a project I'm working on, I went back and watched the 2014 film Hannah Arendt, which is basically just a film about Hannah Arendt right in the period when she's writing Eichmann in Jerusalem, and was delighted to find out it's a really engaging film, a very accurate film. And it also kind of covers two things that come up a lot these days, which are the banality of evil and cancel culture, interestingly enough, because, of course, she took a huge amount of flack for writing Eichmann in Jerusalem and for naming Eichmann, who had kind of been a chief architect of The Final Solution, as a mediocre man who was following rules. And she meant something very specific by that. But rewatching it, I was kind of thinking about how you say things and then people kind of put them in a context other than what you meant. And then there's a big fallout from that. So that film's on Amazon Prime, I think, with like a Fandor subscription, but it's totally worth it.
I think, again, an issue with theaters not being out is I watch a combination of like stuff, if you're, you know, doing festival screenings that you don't know when it's coming out exactly, or it's not coming out for a while, and like stuff that's like pretty old at this point. So my roommate and I just finished watching On Becoming a God in Central Florida, which we're about a year late to the party, but that was enjoyable. Yeah, Kirsten Dunst is always good. I'm trying to think, anything else that I've seen recently? I'm Pregnant on HBO Max is one that I found surprisingly kind of fun and enjoyable. I think Haley Lee Richardson is always great. And then book-wise, I feel like it's probably several months old at this point, but I read The Vanishing Half by Britt Bennett, and that was a brilliant book. I think HBO bought the rights to develop it to something, so I'm curious to see what they do with that. I think it's a great book. I remember reading it being like, oh yeah, nope, someone's going to want to make this into a movie or a limited series, and looks like they are. So curious to see how that plays out.
Yeah, I heard really, really good things about that book. I just put it on my Goodreads list.
Okay. Yes. Yes. No, it's, I would definitely recommend it. I'm curious now. I think the author has written one other book before, so now I'm curious to see her first book, because I thought it was very well done.
On the front for me, I just finished it's just one season of Away that came out on Netflix. I know it was, I think it was trending in the US still is. I thought it was pretty good. It's with astronauts. They're going to be the first group to land on Mars. And it's like a joint initiative between a bunch, five different countries. And it basically the whole time they spend on the ship and they go through all these trials and tribulations. It was a pretty good show. I want to start Lovecraft Country. I'm kind of late to the game on that because I think the first season is almost already done, if not already. Yeah. So hopefully I can binge watch that at some point. I was recently hiking in Zion National Park, so I haven't been watching all that much TV. I've been trying to get outside. And then on the book front, I am about 300 pages into Stephen King's The Institute. It's very, very good. It's about these young children from all over the U.S. who have been kidnapped by the Institute, and they are trying to figure out what all these tests the Institute is running on them are for and why they have certain special powers. I will not spoil, but it's very good. It's very Stephen King, but it's good so far. So, and I haven't done much on the game front since last time. I know last time I mentioned Quiddler, but I haven't played anything besides What Do You Meme since then. So there's not a lot of table games or card games going on as much as there was back in, like, let's say April.
Well, I have been like seeing things that have recently come out that have either been adapted or are being adapted. And instead of waiting for them to come out or watching them, I usually end up going to the other thing. I just looking at my list of things that I have before me, I was like, oh, a lot of these have been adapted, but I'm not looking at the adaptation or in reverse. So, for instance, I am about halfway through Annihilation by Jeff Vandermeer, which was made into a movie with Keira Knightley.
Natalie Portman. It was not Keira Knightley.
Pardon me. Natalie Portman.
Yeah, Lance Portman.
Party foul.
That would be a different movie.
That would be.
Natalie Portman. Excuse me. Sorry, I had Keira Knightley on the brain because we said it earlier.
No worries. I literally tweeted about Keira Knightley the other day and someone responded with Annihilation and I was like, that is not a Keira Knightley movie, so you are not alone. Oh my.
Yes, with Natalie Portman. And I actually don't know if the movie did super well. I know it got pretty good reviews, but in sales, I don't think it did super well.
It didn't.
The book, book, I can say,
yeah,
is very good so far. It was odd at first. It was just a little slow for the first, I don't know, 20 pages, and then it really, really ramped up and is simple and sparse, but very, very interesting. And I still have a lot of questions about it, so I'm looking forward to finishing that.
I'd recommend the movie. I personally love the movie. Not everyone.
Okay,
did,
well, that's
did.
Good to know. I liked everything that I saw from the promotional material, so I'll have to give it a chance. And
okay,
you know, so
that might be an issue though, because like I think that was the issue with the movie, is that the promotional materials and the movie are two very different things. I don't think they knew how to promote the movie, but it's Alex Garland, okay, like 28 Days Later and Ex Machina, and I think it's really great.
It's a great movie.
Yeah, I do like Ex Machina, and I like the book so far, so hopefully they'll kind of meet in the middle and I'll be able to find something I really like about it. With Natalie Portman, not Keira Knightley. I'm also reading, or am going to start right after that, The Fifth Season by N.K. Jemisin, which is a really, really amazing and well-reviewed fantasy novel. I believe it's the first of a trilogy as well. I've read the first chapter of it and then had to put it down. For some reason, I got really distracted, but I'm very excited to do that. And it's about a world that is very commonly undergoing crazy climate change phenomena that takes the form of these massive apocalypse-like scenarios. A podcast I would recommend is One Way to Make an Emoji by Alex Schmidt.
Where do you find these?
I know, right? It is literally about a man who I believe is like a Jeopardy winner at one point, but he proposed to Unicode the bison emoji and they accepted it. And he does a 4-part miniseries about the history of the American bison and why there needs to be an emoji for it.
I love it.
And it is, by the time you get to the end, I don't want to spoil it for you. It is not what you think, and it will tug at your heartstrings and be...
What?
It's very real. It's very odd.
I'm so intrigued.
One Way to Make an Emoji by Alex Schmidt. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. And Song Exploder, I've been re-listening to, especially because Hrishikesh Hirway just announced that it is now going to be, I believe, at the end of this week, as of we're recording, on Netflix as a documentary series with people like Alicia Keys and Lin-Manuel Miranda. If you're interested in music production and writing and that type of thing, you can find an episode for any type of genre, and chances are if it's a pretty big artist, then there's a good chance that they've done an episode and been interviewed and have sort of gone through their creative process, and I highly recommend it. And I also just finished watching the documentary I'll Be Gone in the Dark, which is the story of Michelle McNamara, who was a great true crime author, and her work was really influential in the helping to catch the Golden State Killer, who also went by, you know, original Night Stalker and East Area Rapist in the Sacramento area many, many years ago. A lot of people know her as Patton Oswalt's ex-wife, but she's an amazing writer in her own sense. And I think as someone who doesn't really like true crime and can see it as kind of, you know, gawking in a lot of ways, they do a very, very good job of making it about the people that were victims of this heinous thing without being intrusive and disrespectful to them. Because that was a very big part of the way that she wrote the book that they ended up publishing that the documentary is then based on. So I highly recommend I'll Be Gone in the Dark.
I would second that recommendation because I do go through true crime binges, but that is a good one. Yeah, I was unsure how they were going to approach that story because there is always that kind of, is it kind of too gawking when it's true crime? But I, that one was ultimately very well done docuseries.
It was odd to watch that. And then I was like, oh, well, I'll just watch The Jinx because I had HBO open. And then I watched Robert Durst and I was like, oh, this is very different.
It is very different. I've watched both of those too. I have HBO Max and I went on a true crime kick a while back. And so, yes, those are very, very different.
Thanks for listening. As a result of Jordan Peele's horror comedies, we, as an audience, have been able to have deeper conversations about self-identity and what it means to come to grips with our troubled past. As always, be sure to follow us on Twitter at Pop and Lock Pod. That's Pop, the letter N, Lock, with an E, Pod. Make sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. We look forward to unraveling your favorite show or movie next time. Pop and Lock is produced by Landry Ayres as a project of libertarianism.org. To learn more, visit us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.